Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop what
you're doing. Periodically, it is worth remembering just how much the American founders detested the signs of a bloated state. Standing armies, a large fiscal military federation, and a capacious national bureaucracy. It may be going too far to say that today's conservatives would denounce the founding fathers as unpatriotic. Actually, I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. I think that if James Madison, or for that matter, George Washington, were somehow to materialize at a stereotypical Republican-aligned Tea Party event. Note the qualifiers there. Not every Tea Party event, of course, would fit the description I just offered. But let's say a meeting of Hannitized Tea Partiers. If you had George Washington or James Madison or Thomas Jefferson appear incognito and simply start quoting themselves, albeit in terminology that would be updated and dumbed down to be made suitable and digestible by contemporary intellects, that these people would be denounced as being Soros-funded cultural Marxists. If you had James Madison reciting from his warning about war being the most fearsome enemy of public liberty, he'd probably be denounced as an Obama-loving liberal, when, of course, Mr. Obama differs not one whit from his predecessor when it comes to the aggrandizement of the national security, homeland security, garrison state, however you want to characterize the monstrosity that is in charge in Washington. The writer of this piece, by the way, is Justin Logan of the Cato Institute. It may be going too far to say that today's conservatives would denounce the founding fathers as unpatriotic, but not much too far. While members of the right now flutter like schoolgirls at the mention of military leaders like General David Petraeus, the founders scorned the prospect of military leaders becoming figures of worshipful esteem. As the historian Arthur Eckrich has highlighted, aversion to standing armies and centralism was at the heart of the American founding. In 1783, Revolutionary War veteran Aedanus Burke warned, quote, "Military commanders acquiring fame are generally in their hearts aristocrats and enemies to the popular equality of a republic." John Randolph, there's one of my founding heroes, John Randolph, saw no serious threats to the republic and accordingly denounced the army as, quote, "loungers who live upon the public, who consume the fruits of their honest industry under the pretext of protecting them from a foreign yoke." Randolph sneered at the idea that a country of virtuous and self-sufficient republicans, small r republicans, I hasten to clarify, would be forced to seek, quote, "the protection of a handful of ragamuffins." Benjamin Rush suggested placing signs above the entrance to the Department of War reading, "an office for butchering the human species," and "a widow and orphan-making office." The early republic had a high tolerance for danger. Let me stop for just a second and exegete that comment a little bit. A high tolerance for danger. It had a high tolerance for purported danger emanating from foreign threats. It had no tolerance at all, quite frankly, or very little tolerance for domestic threats that emanated from the government nearest them. The small r Republican disposition of our founding generation was one that recognized that the proximate and most pronounced danger comes from the government ruling us, not from some distant bey or czar or emperor, but rather from Congress, your state legislature, your city or village government. They understood that we should be much more concerned about what was going on in our own country, our own state, our own community, than the machinations of great empires overseas. And this wasn't simply a geographical issue either. Granted, they had the luxury of being separated from Europe by a vast ocean. But more importantly, they understood the danger of mixing power with fallen human nature, and the fact that anybody who exercises power is going to be troublesome when it comes to the liberty of the individuals over whom he purports to exercise that power. So Mr. Logan writes, the early republic had a high tolerance for danger, meaning, of course, danger of the sort that now preoccupies us more or less constantly. Oh, eek. There's an omnipotent troglodyte living in the trackless wastes of Afghanistan who can somehow threaten our lives. Indeed, he can somehow destroy our consumer culture and force our women into burqas and force our men to grow scraggly beards. You know what? Newt Gingrich, that overfed popinjay, that purulent specimen of corruption, that serial adulterer, that socialist New Age Elmer Gantry literally used the expression I just paraphrased in a speech to the American Enterprise Institute just a couple of days ago, talking about the supposed threat of the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which A, isn't a mosque, and B, wouldn't be near Ground Zero, and C, shouldn't be considered in any way, shape, or form a potent symbol of Muslim victory, because if I remember correctly, there's been a mosque near the Pentagon for a long, long time. If they wanted to build a mosque symbolizing a victory over American power, they'd be talking about perhaps building another mosque near the scene of the Pentagon. And all this assumes, of course, that the standard narrative of 9/11 is correct, and quite frankly, I don't make that assumption. I keep my own counsel as to what I think is the likeliest description of what went down on that terrible morning. But I think that in the larger scheme of things, the role played by the proverbial 19 box cutter wielding Arabs would have been, in my opinion, at the very most, that of subcontractors, assuming, of course, that they had a significant role in bringing about that atrocity. I'm not sure that's the case, but that's another subject for another time. But the point I'm making here is the news is trying to whip up fears of America being laid waste and held captive by the myrmidons of foreign Islamic conquerors who would make the men grow scraggly beards and stuff the women to burqas. He literally was using those expressions. Well, you know what? That wasn't how the founding generation, who lived in a country that was far less powerful and far easier prey for powerful empires, bear in mind, that's not how they calculated danger. The British had set fire to the White House during the War of 1812, and remained in North America, openly refusing to comply with the terms of the Treaty of Ghent. One might compare the gravity of this threat to that posed by Afghanistan's own handful of ragamuffins today. Even so, the U.S. Army was slashed in size from roughly 47,000 men during the War of 1812, to less than 10,000 after it. This tiny force accounted for more than three-fourths of the federal spending at the time. Boy, wouldn't that be something? We've come a long way. Today, people who call themselves conservatives promote endless nation-building projects overseas. They endorse a gross imbalance of power at the domestic level, pitting a sorry, supine Congress against a super-empowered, quasi-regal presidency and administrative state. They shrug at flamboyant federal spending and hew to an American identity that is rooted more in worship of the state than in Republican humility and deference to God. I find it hard to believe this guy writes for Cato. How did this happen? How did a decentralized republic become a homogenized, staggering titan bestriding the globe and attempting to transform everything from the social conduct of Iraqi families to the business practices of American banks, car companies, and healthcare providers? The factor that explains the largest share of the centralism and growth of the American state is war. In War, Revenue, and State Building, Financing the Development of the American State, Sheldon D. Pollack, professor and director of the Legal Studies Program at the University of Delaware, sets out to trace war's role in facilitating that expansion. The book is a synthetic account, meaning, of course, it draws on several different disciplines, not that it's artificial, The book is a synthetic account that includes a review of the scholarly literature on state building in Europe, a sweep through mostly secondary sources describing the founding of the American state, and a third section detailing the growth of the military state from the Civil War onward. Given the extensive existing literature and the broader and deeper treatments of these subjects by scholars such as Otto Hinze, Frederick Lane, Charles Tilly, Bruce Porter, I mentioned Bruce Porter's book earlier, War and the State, Robert Higgs, and many others, however, one searches mostly in vain for value added beyond the book's use as a roadmap of existing literature. That flaw being duly noted, there are insights from that book I will share on the other side of the break. This is Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Stand by for more sedition after these messages.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Griggs.
I've been reading from this essay entitled An Empire If You Can Keep It by Justin Logan of the Cato Institute. It's on the website of the American Conservative magazine, which I believe right now is probably the best and most provocative right-leaning journal of opinion and news in the country, American Conservative Magazine. Don't write for them very often. I've written for them before as a freelancer. I think that they have grown beyond their origins, and their origins, I think, were really quite commendable. That was a magazine founded by Tacky Theodorakopoulos and Patrick Buchanan, and it does have a little of Tacky, that's how Tacky Theodorakopoulos is commonly referred to, some of Tacky's insidious wit, and a lot of Patrick Buchanan's views regarding what you'd call paleoconservative nationalism, but they have broadened their palette considerably. Now they're starting to engage in the discussion in terms of what we'd call libertarian or agorist or individualist views, and trying to examine how those intersect with conservative values. And I think this is all to the good. Mr. Logan's with Cato Institute, which typically tends to be a little bit too establishmentarian for my taste. That being said, this is a very good analysis of the apostasy from our founding principles with respect to that government program that is the taproot of every other government overgrowth. And that is war. He's reading, or actually not reading, he is examining the views and insights found in the book War, Revenue, and State Building, Financing the Development of the American State by Sheldon D. Pollack. And Mr. Logan has made note of the fact that there are a couple of weaknesses here. They have to do primarily with the fact that there's not a whole lot in that book by way of original research or primary sources, but it does offer a good overview and commentary about the fundamental question, which is this: how on earth did we end up with a unitary Leviathan state, militarist in nature, grotesquely overgrown, given the fact that the founding generation, if you calculate the founding generation to run from roughly 1789 through, let's say, 1828, the founding generation coveted the liberties that had been wrested from England, and they were determined to preserve a decentralized political order based on, among other things, a thoroughgoing aversion to war as a government program. How many would argue with the thesis, writes Mr. Logan, that the remarkable institutional transformation of the American state would not have been possible but for the revenue raised through a particularly efficient system of public finance devised by national political leaders during the Civil War and subsequently resurrected and perfected in the early 20th century. What they're talking about, by the way, here is the idea of debt-financed government expansion, fiat money and the use of debt as a way of driving the expansion of the military and of the government in Washington as a support apparatus for the military. Pollack's account of the rise of the American state can be summarized as follows, continues Mr. Logan. Founded on the dubious principle that tyrannical political power can be checked by denying the central government all the fundamental powers and attributes of stateness, the American state was crippled by structural defects that made the early American Republic a quote-unquote failure. The need to band together to resist the threat from Britain forced the decision to unify the 13 former colonies into a confederacy. Even so, the medieval princes of 12th century Europe were better equipped to raise revenue for their armies. Even with its limited capacities, Congress begged and borrowed enough for the effort to defeat the crown and founded a sovereign state with the ratification of the Constitution in 1787. The exertions of Alexander Hamilton helped overcome the early politicians' aversion to centralized power. By the way, Hamilton was not merely overcoming an aversion to centralized power. He was trying to enthrone the bond-issuing class and the mercantilist class associated with it as the dominant element in the new American polity, at the expense, of course, of the yeoman farmers, at the expense of those who were in the productive economy. He wanted the people who would be involved in what's now called arbitrage to be running things. If you want to take a look at Hamilton's Revenge, which, of course, is the name of a terrific book by Tom DiLorenzo on the subject, take a look at what's going on right now as Wall Street literally vacuums up everything in this country to service the interests of those sustained through this system of corporate socialism. The critical periods of government growth occurred during the Civil War, World War I, and World War II. Pollack offers a catalog of statistics that reflects the growth in administrative capacity and expenditures during these conflicts. He rightly keys in on the income tax, formally adopted in 1861 as a watershed in American state building. The Union government looked like the fiscal military state of Great Britain, but the Confederacy's revenue strategy more nearly resembled tribute-taking empires such as Russia, lending a decisive advantage to the North in the military contest between the two armies. In other words, the chief advantage was not the manufacturing capacity of the North, it was the capacity of the Union government to extract revenue that was the decisive factor in its victory. To continue, Pollack offers a useful discussion of how the growth of pensions for Union veterans laid the foundation for the administrative state. Originally paying only disabled veterans, widows, and orphans, Congress expanded the pension system to include dependent fathers and brothers, then again to pay Union veterans who had served for at least 90 days and were disabled, whether related to the war or not. Enabled by budget surpluses, Republicans began using pensions as party-building measures. That was in that same period of time that I mentioned in the first hour of this program, the 1880s and 1890s, when the tariff-funded Republican oligarchy was putting the screws to the embryonic middle class. And that resulted in the populist movement, which unfortunately was misdirected, artfully misled into supporting, among other things, the Federal Reserve. The author's account of World War I brings striking statistics. The cost of the first year of war was greater than the expenditures of the entire government from 1791 through 1917. Let me repeat that. The cost of the first year of World War I was greater than the expenditures of the entire government from 1791 through 1917. Those two dates, incidentally, are anagrams. That's interesting. Not significant, but it's interesting. An ample proof of the so-called ratchet effect by which a government's power never shrinks after a war to the level it was before the war. But perhaps the final nail in the coffin of the American Republic was the 1-2 punch of World War II and the Cold War. Strikingly, Pollack's treatment of the growth of the American state during World War II spans fewer than 8 pages, and as such, he misses interesting details. For example, one of the important contributors to the working group at the Treasury Department that successfully promoted income tax withholding as a way to increase revenue went on to become a leader of the free market movement, Milton Friedman. That, by the way, is something I have a difficult time forgiving. It was also Milton Friedman, by the way, who helped end the gold standard, so he's somebody who's got a lot to pay in purgatory, if you believe in purgatory. Friedman would note in a 1995 interview that he thought withholding tax was a great mistake for peacetime, but in 1941 to 43, all of us were concentrating on war. He did not regret his role, but wished that there were some way of abolishing withholding now. This demonstrates how the exigencies of war overcame an instinctive American anti-statism, which is why war is so useful to the statists, and why nothing we do by way of trying to pare back the state will avail us anything unless we strike at the root, and the root is the warfare function. to continue. War, revenue, and state building concludes on a solemn note. Despite the increasingly ingenious efforts to extract resources from its citizens, the American state faces important structural fiscal shortfalls, an infantile policy that clamors for both tax cuts and increased welfare payments diminishes the prospect of solvency. Even voters who assure pollsters that they seek less government, in the abstract, perennially elect politicians who nurse them with a variety of benefits, only part of which are paid for by taxes. Again, I advert to the Tea Party movement. How often do you find some Tea Party movement events festooned with banners saying, don't give us socialized medicine and don't cut our Medicare? Cognitive dissonance, anyone? This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. So here's the thing. We have an electorate, a polity and an electorate here in this country of people who have detailed supernatural perception when it comes to the size, the texture, the shape, the consistency, and the surface characteristics of the microscopic mote that is occluding the vision of his neighbor. But they are, at the same time, we should say we are, each of us, all of us in the aggregate, each of us individually, puzzlingly oblivious to the existence of the beam that is obstructing our vision regarding our own deficiencies. That's, of course, a human characteristic. It has been since Adam said, well, you see, the problem is you gave me this woman and she suggested this. We all love to defer or to misdirect responsibility for our own actions, our own bad choices. And as Frederick Bastiat put it 160 years ago, thereabouts, the whole logic of statism, socialism, collectivism, whatever ism you want to use by way of describing this system, is based on the idea of each person living at the expense of the others. So we have a situation here where, as Justin Logan points out, paraphrasing this book by Dr. Sheldon Pollack of the Legal Studies Program at the University of Delaware, the book in question is called War, Revenue, and State Building. We have a system now in which people want to retain their entitlements, and they do not want to see their taxes increased. Of course, the problem here is that the true cost of government, in terms of its impact on your financial life, your economic life, is the size of the government and the amount that it spends. It's not how much is taken in direct taxes. People don't understand that. And that's one of the reasons, I suspect, why at your Tea Party gatherings, assuming, of course, that you'd even refer to the Tea Party now as a vivid, active movement. I understand that earlier today one of my colleagues here at Liberty News Radio pronounced the death knell for the Tea Party movement. He's probably right. I don't know if we'd agree about the reasons for that obituary or that eulogy, but for the most part, the Tea Party movement has become an adjunct of the Republican Party. And it's being used to sculpt a partisan campaign in order to thrust the Republican Party back into prominence by seizing control of Congress in the election this year as a prelude to taking back the White House. So you'll have Collectivist Party A rather than Collectivist Party B enthroned, and the world will just keep on spinning, and our economic collapse will accelerate and deepen. But at many of these Tea Party movement events, it's commonplace to see signs accusing the same Obama administration of at once trying to impose socialized medicine on us, which, of course, it's doing, trying to do. It's something that's a perfect catastrophe and an utter atrocity from an economic and constitutional point of view. And many of the same people who are condemning the Obama administration for doing so are accusing him of secretly planning to cut Medicare. we really can't have it both ways, but people want to have it both ways. And one of the unfortunate things about the American culture is that we believe that it is possible to give expression to every faint wish or desire in the expectation that they will be fulfilled. And that's not a rational way to live one's life. But that's how we've been raised. That's how we in this generation in particular have been raised. And that translates in political terms into a sense of entitlement that tends to disfigure even the political views of people who profess to want to get government off their backs. They want government off their back, but they want government to be providing them with things that constitute, quite frankly, receipt of stolen property. That's why Mr. Logan writes, even voters who assure pollsters that they seek less government in the abstract perennially elect politicians who nurse them with a variety of benefits, only part of which are paid for by taxes. Meanwhile, a commercialized nationalism thrusts a self-selected few out into the world to sow social virtue abroad while the rest of us go shopping. Belief in self-restraint and Republican virtue has all but vanished as generation after generation of Americans marvel like idiot children at the latest baubles proffered by electronics manufacturers. The American foreign policy establishment prefers that the American taxpayer fund the defenses of Europe, Japan, and a host of other places rather than allowing foreign governments to do so themselves. As Pollack observes, quote, the system is financially unsustainable, and yet, if one had sketched out on paper the predicament America faces today, overborrowed, overcommitted, and over there, many would have predicted collapse long ago. Pollack's volume does a service if it succeeds in introducing the broader literature on state building to students of American politics. While the founders sought to steer a new course and avoid replicating the European state in North America, Pollack points out that the great irony is that the American state they build eventually became more powerful than the mighty states of Europe they so feared and despised. Those who profess to admire the founding fathers and the principles they pursued should consider whether the American state that exists today is worthy of the esteem bestowed upon it. The political scientist Hans Morgenthau wrote, throughout the nation's history, the national destiny of the United States has been understood in anti-militaristic libertarian terms. But perhaps this understanding was wrong all along. Maybe our ultimate destiny was to become what we revolted against in the first place. To the phones we go. Rob from Colorado has joined us this evening. Good evening, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm good, as long as you don't cut my Medicaid.
Well, I don't have that power, and likely by the time I'm old enough to benefit from it, it won't exist, so the question is academic, I suppose.
It won't be a benefit, so I wouldn't worry about it one way or another.
That's true.
2 points I wanted to pick your brain on, if I could, Doctor. First off, a lot of talk about the French Revolution, and I come from a position of having never studied it, so I'm completely ignorant about it other than what I've heard. And it was my understanding that it was in the late 1700s, I think, when a bunch of the French people got pissed off about being mistreated and stormed the Bastille and told Henry the 14th or whoever was in charge at that time that no more of this, we're not going to take it. A lot of people died, and they then won their independence. Now I'm hearing, you know, I've listened to Alex Jones a couple of times, and he had someone else on there, Bob Chapman, talking about it. And I think from what they were saying, it was actually an attack on the middle class. They wanted to wreck the family, take things over. It wasn't a revolution at all. It was an attack against the people. So if you know anything about the French Revolution, give me a quick tutorial.
Well, about 40 years ago, in the early 1960s, somebody asked Zhou Enlai, of course, he was the second most powerful man in communist China, what he thought about the French Revolution. He said, it's too early to tell. And that's a somewhat cynical, but in its own way, sort of perspicuous way of looking at it, because the radiating effects of the French Revolution are still being felt today. It started out as a revolt against the inflationary policies of the French government, and those inflationary policies, ironically enough, were the result of France intervening to help the American colonies achieve their independence from Great Britain. You know, France had just gotten kicked out of most of North America at the end of the Seven Years' War. What we call the French and American War was the Seven Years' War globally. And they really wanted to take a piece out of the British Empire, and so they had an opportunity once that group of anti-statist, anti-militarist, libertarian ne'er-do-wells wanted to cast off the yoke of the British crown. They appealed to France for help, and France, of course, was happy to lend their support and then bottle up the fleet at the harbor there at Yorktown. And in spite of the efforts on the scene to surrender to the French deferred. They said, no, you're going to have to surrender to the American colonists. Well, they ran up a huge bill in doing this, and that led to inflation back in France, and that translated into a middle-class uprising and revolt that I think was co-opted by people in the elite that wanted to overthrow Louis Capet, Louis XVI, and supplant him with people of a different worldview outright. There were people who were sort of loosely organized through the Grand Orient, not the Grand Orient, forgive me, the Grand Orient Freemason Lodge was something that played a very significant role in organizing this. A couple of really good books on that subject. James Billington's Fire in the Minds of Men is one really good book on the subject. Rousseau and Revolution by Will and Ariel Durant, The Age of Voltaire by Will and Ariel Durant, The Age of Napoleon, they all talk about this. But the Palais Royal, which was sort of the royal court, had all these intriguers who were stuffed to the brim with all these humanistic designs. They wanted to overthrow the Catholic monarchy and install a more humanistic regime, and so they co-opted the middle-class uprising against the king. And at the time, things in France were not nearly as bad as they were elsewhere in the continent, notwithstanding the inflation. But they were, the people promoting this revolution were masters at mass psychology, and they were able to manipulate people into supporting this revolt. Rob, do you want to stick through the break, and we'll pick this up on the other side of the break?
Yeah, I do have them.
Okay, Robert will be back with us on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in a minute. So Rob from Colorado has asked a question about the French Revolution and whether it was an event in history that helped to bring about a more just order, or if it was something that happened as a result of ambitions of entrenched people to increase the power of government over the middle class. The thing is, there are many phases of the French Revolution. There are many things that led to the Siege of the Bastille in 1789, and that's been typically misrepresented. As I understand, the reason why the people stormed the Bastille is they wanted to get arms out of that prison to defend the king. And that created a furor and a tumult that later helped to break down civic order in France. But the real nasty business of the French Revolution begins around 1790 or 1791 when the Jacobins come to power in the assembly in France. And they decree the Revolutionary Terror. They create what's called the Law of Suspects. They created a system in which the Catholic priests of France suddenly had to swear an oath of allegiance to the government in Paris rather than to the Pope in Rome. They became juring priests, and non-juring priests were considered enemies of the realm. And then in April of 1793, the revolutionary government decided to enact a conscription decree that would scoop up these Catholic young men, these school children, these schoolboys and young adults, and send them abroad to fight on behalf of a government in Paris they despised against other Catholic kingdoms with whom they had a great deal in common. And that led to a revolt in a region called Lavanda, and he ended up with probably 250,000 to 300,000 people who were killed in that section, that department of France, because they rebelled against the government in France. And meanwhile, of course, this was a regime that had erected a forest of guillotines in Paris and elsewhere, and they were putting people to death for offenses against the new revolutionary order. They rewrote the calendar to take out references to, for instance, the first day of the week. Why do we call Sunday the first day of the week? Well, it's because in the Christian calendar, that's the Lord's Day. That's the day of the resurrection. Well, why are there 7 days in a week? Well, because the Bible talks about seven time periods called days that have to do with the creation. Why is it called the Sabbath? Well, that's when the Lord rested. Well, we can't have that calendar because we're starting the world anew. And so they created a 10-day calendar. They renamed the months of the year. It became a totalitarian exercise, in other words, Rob. And I believe, after studying the literature on the subject, that was the intention. I believe that's the reason why these people seized power in France to begin with. And so I think that what happened is that you had a middle-class revolt that was very carefully exploited. And first of all, it was cultivated, it was misled, it was misdirected. And then you ended up with a seizure of power by people in the name of by a little oligarchy, a little group of people purporting to represent the population at large, that ended up making war on the population at large and killing hundreds of thousands of them in pursuit of this demented dream of creating a new world through violence. And things got to be so off the scale bad with inflation and tumult and warfare that in 1799, a scruffy little Corsican by the name of Bonaparte emerged from the chaos as the first consul, because he was the one member of the French imperial military who was willing to train his cannon on the mob in Paris and disperse it by giving them a whiff of grapeshot. And so he ended up taking power, and he spent the next decade and a half careening about Europe, creating history in orphans. One of the few things about Napoleon I find admirable is the fact that he went off the fiat money system that France had succumbed to during the revolution, and he actually reimposed the gold standard. That's one of the few things that I find admirable about what's otherwise a pretty detestable customer. Anyhow, Rob, I'm sorry to give short shrift to that subject, and it's one, as I point out, that really requires a lot of investment of time and effort to study. I mentioned a couple of books. I'll just mention a couple more here. I mentioned The Age of Napoleon, Rousseau and Revolution, and The Age of Voltaire by Will and Ariel Durand and their History of Civilization series. I mentioned James Billington's Fire in the Minds of Men, The Origins of the Revolutionary Faith. That's available now in a very good mass-market paperback edition. I think Mr. Billington is still the Librarian of Congress. And he talks about the influence of that bête noire of conspiracists like myself, the Bavarian Illuminati, in bringing about the French Revolution and the rise of Napoleon, and how that coalesced a couple of decades later into the movement that became the Communist International. And then another very good popular scholarly work by British historian named Simon Schama, S-C-H-A-M-A, Citizens. It came out in 1989. It came out on the bicentennial of the French Revolution. And, of course, no list of this sort can be complete without Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke. There are two volumes of that collection of essays. The first was written, I believe, in 1790. I don't remember when the second was written, but typically only the first edition is available. If you can get both, that's very worthwhile. So, Robert, I hate to do this as well, but I've got to go because we've got another caller on the line who's been waiting. Tony from California has been waiting very patiently. Tony, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you doing?
Doing well, sir. Hey, heard what you're saying about the Tea Party movement and how that sort of de-evolved. Recently, in the California primaries a few months ago, they had, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this candidate, Chuck DeVore. He is a state assemblyman, and he tends to be, probably a bit more fiscally conservative than your box standard type of Republican, but he's very much a warmonger. He was addressing a Tea Party movement and says, your number one mission in the state of California, you Tea Partiers, is to reform the Republican Party. So if anybody had any doubt if that Tea Party movement now, the current one, the contemporary one, isn't controlled opposition, there's your proof. I mean, they've been absolutely co-opted, and they're not even worth fooling with.
I'm afraid that's the case. And, of course, this is a really good example of the sort of movement that emerged spontaneously. This is not something that was programmed or orchestrated by the people who were in charge of conducting focus groups and sculpting political movements. This is something that emerged spontaneously as really sort of an adjunct to the Ron Paul movement. And it only took about 6 or 8 months for the political operatives in Washington to find out how they could create an undertow that would suck this movement in their direction. And what they're doing, I believe, is in a way sort of a junior league version of what happened in the French Revolution. You had the same type of pressures, the same type of populist resentments. You had in 1789 something called the Cahier de Doléances. That was basically a big petition containing all the sundry grievances of people in the countryside about the effects of inflation and the economic turmoil that was going on. In other words, there was a real populist uprising, a real organized sort of festering dissent that received sort of a sympathetic hearing from Louis XVI, who was not an arbitrary despot. He was a reformer, and that's why things got dangerous for him. He eventually lost his head in 1791 because of that.
Right.
But these people in France were skillfully misled by the same type of opportunistic folks who have co-opted and effectively destroyed the Tea Party movement as an independent voice of authentic middle-class angst. You've got the same thing going on. I'm not trying to say that you're going to have the same result in terms of a domestic reign of terror, but quite frankly, I don't see why that should be ruled completely out, given everything that's going on with the economy, the emergence of this hideous garrison state superstructure, the institutionalization of torture and indefinite detention, infinite and unlimited war abroad. Good grief. It could very easily metastasize into that type of an outcome. It's not necessarily going to happen that way. You know, God willing, it won't, but that's part of the potential, and it's the same mechanism that would bring it about if we end up in that circumstance, I think.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, there's that is a possible scenario, and I fear it's an all too far too real scenario, but even in California, politics is messed up as it is. When Gray Davis was ousted, and they had a state assemblyman here, Tom Campbell, who was leading
him,
in the polls, could have easily won as governor. I believe it was Tom Campbell, but the White House dispatched Arnold Schwarzenegger. They did not, the Republican establishment did not want that man as governor. And you know,
exactly.
Anyone to believe that these things are conspired and these groups are not watched, I mean, they're insane. Obviously they are.
Well, politics is the most fertile ground for ententes and combinations and camarillas and conspiracies. It's because you got people of low ethical character who are seeking to organize themselves to obtain advantage over others through misdirection and deception.
Yes.
And that's where conspiracies come from.
I don't understand, you know, even, you know, with my under 20 years of actually getting into what I would call real history, you know, the things that you write, and H. Ralph Epperson, you know, some other good authors out there, I just can't understand why people think it's so distasteful to utter that C word, as it's a dirty word or some sort of blasphemy. I mean, it's, you know, the history is replete with examples of this, but yet in our time, it just, for some reason, it just, you know, just doesn't roll off the palate too easily from a neoconservative standpoint. But anyway, keep up the good work, and I'll let you get back to it.
Thanks so much. God bless you, Tony. It's good to hear from you. Yep, the C word, conspiracy. You know what? The people who created the big C word, Constitution, were anti-conspiracists. And if you don't understand the Constitution in those terms, the Constitution will mystify you. The Constitution is an anti-conspiratorial document. It's meant to prevent, obstruct, and cure political conspiracy. Having said that, that's the end of Hour 2. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Hour 3 of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. My apologies to Rob, who was dismissed a little bit too abruptly this evening. Hopefully he'll call back next week. This is your humble servant, Will Gregg, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.